our mail starting to slow down. We're not getting a lot of ballots in the mail, but we're still continuing to see a rise in the number of ballots to be counted due to those ballots.
The Division of Elections prepares to count more votes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, environmental groups sue to protect walrus from oil development in the Arctic Ocean.
Allowing activities in the Hanna Shoal without analyzing those impacts just adds to walrus's woes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready to quit smoking using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
After a week of collecting and reviewing absentee and question ballots, the Division of Elections will start counting votes tomorrow. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The Division of Elections has nearly 50,000 uncounted ballots in its possession, with still more coming in. Director Gelfanumiai says it's unlikely that staff will be able to count all of them in one day.
I would love to have half, but I don't know if we're going to be there. I mean, you know, I really am trying to concentrate on those districts that we haven't counted any absentees for yet.
Some of the regional elections offices will start their counts at 9 a.m. In Anchorage, workers will begin opening ballots at 1. Because absentee ballots in some districts have already been counted, Vanumiai says the focus will be on places like Juneau and some districts on the Kenai Peninsula where no absentees have been processed.
I know for sure we're counting the rest of the early votes that haven't been counted, which is just a little over 2,600, but we're hoping to dig into some question ballots and get a bunch of absentee ballots that haven't, for districts that haven't already been counted.
Even after Tuesday's count, the number of ballots could continue to rise. The Division of Elections accepts absentee ballots postmarked within the United States through Friday and has a deadline of November 19th for absentee ballots mailed from abroad. But in recent days, the biggest gains the Division of Elections is seeing is in the category of absentee in-person votes. Those are votes cast at regional elections offices or at the 200-odd voting stations across the state in advance of Election Day. So far, 10,000 absentee in-person ballots have been returned.
Our mail's starting to slow down. We're not getting a lot of ballots in the mail, but we're still continuing to see a rise in the number of ballots to be counted due to those ballots.
So here's where there's a big question over the total number of votes cast. The Division of Elections has a sense of how many mailed absentee ballots they have to process because those ballots need to be requested in advance. But Vanumiai says there isn't an estimate of how many more absentee in-person votes may come in because those ballots don't require any sort of early paperwork from voters.
It would require a daily monitoring of 200-plus locations to find out how many people did you vote today. So it's just something that isn't done because that's a huge task.
Right now, neither the Senate race nor the gubernatorial race has a clear winner. Republican Dan Sullivan leads Democratic incumbent Mark Begich by 8,000 votes in the Senate race, while unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker has a 3,000-vote lead over Republican Governor Sean Parnell. The Division of Elections expects to update its unofficial results by early evening on Tuesday. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A coalition of environmental groups filed a lawsuit today against the Fish and Wildlife Service, saying its rule allowing the oil industry to disturb or harm Pacific walrus in the Chukchi Sea violates the Marine Mammal Protection Act. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Earth Justice attorney Eric Graffy says the rule the Fish and Wildlife Service issued last year isn't specific enough to protect walrus from seismic work, oil drilling, and other industry activity in the Chukchi Sea.
Instead, the rule defers analysis of the impacts of oil and gas activities at the Hanna Shoal and mitigation of those effects to a later stage that is not subject to public comment and that people don't get to know about until after the fact.
The waters governed by the rule off Alaska's northwest shore include an area where Shell has leases and may resume exploration as early as next year. The Fish and Wildlife Service determined industrial activity would harm only a small number of walrus. The rule requires aircraft to stay away from the animals and limits seismic noise when walrus are present. Graffy says walrus are already suffering from a massive loss of sea ice that used to allow them to rest closer to their foraging grounds. Now, Graffy says, they congregate on land in summer and travel to productive areas like the Hannah Shoal, a 30-mile shallow shelf that's near Shell's Burger Prospect.
So what they're having to do is swim all the way from those coastal haulouts all the way out to the Hannah Shoal to feed, and then swim all the way back. And this is mothers and calves, and it's a huge burden on them and a huge stress. And allowing activities in the Hannah Shoal without analyzing those impacts just adds to walrus's woes.
Kara Moriarty, president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, says walrus are already protected by law. She says the Fish and Wildlife Service rule includes flexibility so companies can meet protection standards using the latest technology. Moriarty says her group is still studying the suit.
It appears at first blush anyway, this could just be another attempt to delay progress through frivolous litigation, because we've certainly seen our fair share of that.
Earth Justice filed the lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the Alaska Wilderness League, Greenpeace, and four other environmental groups. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska will continue its court battle against a U.S. Forest Service policy that blocks logging in undeveloped areas of national forests. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled Friday that the state can resume legal action against what's called the roadless rule. A lower court had thrown the case out, saying the state missed a key deadline. Tom Lenhart, the state attorney involved in the case, says it's back on track.
The Circuit Court of Appeals agrees that our case was filed timely, and they have remanded it back to the district court. So basically, we get to pick up our legal challenge where we left off in the district court.
Logging opponents say the Clinton-era roadless rule should remain on the books. It's been in and out of court several times. Buck Lindekugel is an attorney for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
We're confident that the D.C. Circuit will ultimately find the roadless rule valid, just like both the Ninth and Tenth Circuits have already concluded. We are also taking a hard look at whether or not to seek a full court reviewing of last week's decision.
Roadless rule supporters say it's needed to protect old-growth forests and salmon habitat. State officials say it's hurting the timber industry by blocking logging and road building. The suit was filed in 2011. The state filed a separate lawsuit against the Forest Service that same year. It attempted to resurrect a Tongass exemption from the rule. State Attorney Lenhart says oral arguments are scheduled for mid-December. He says the case the D.C. court acted on last week is larger.
It is actually challenging the validity of the entire roadless rule, whereas our case in Alaska in the Ninth Circuit is only about a special exemption for the Tongass.
The state has intervened on the side of the Forest Service in a separate lawsuit trying to block the Bighorn timber sale on Prince of Wales Island. That suit was brought by environmental and fisheries groups objecting to the sale's impacts on fish and wildlife habitat. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, living on a houseboat in Juneau.
Our space and boundaries are different than most people's, and rather than sit around and whine about it, you just suck it up and you just do what you gotta do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
7 teenagers were involved in an attack on unarmed guards at a Kenai Peninsula juvenile detention facility Friday night. 5 escaped the facility and were apprehended over the weekend. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
2 unarmed juvenile justice officers were injured Friday night at the Kenai Peninsula Youth Facility. That's according to Karen Forrest, the director of the State Division of Juvenile Justice.
It is a very serious event. I'm very troubled by it, saddened by it.
No details are being released about the extent of the officers' injuries. Forrest says officers at the juvenile facility do not carry weapons or pepper spray. She says the department will be carefully evaluating the incident to see what can be done to ensure staff safety in the future.
The safety of the youth and the staff in the facility is critical and is a top priority, so we definitely are going to be looking at that.
5 of the 7 teens involved escaped from the facility. 3 were found in Kenai, and 2 others were located by authorities in Nikiski on Saturday.
All 5 of the youth have been located and are in custody, and 4 were returned to the Division of Juvenile Justice, and 1 is 18 and is being addressed through the adult system. And we had all youth back in custody within 24 hours. Of the event.
Forrest stresses that while there have been similar incidents in the past, they are rare. An investigation is underway to determine preventative measures for the future. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Though the final count is still pending, unofficial results show Alaskans voting yes to legalizing marijuana in last week's election. But the road to a legal and regulated marijuana market is months away, and communities who still want to keep the divisive drug out are looking at doing so the same way many currently ban alcohol, through the local option. KNOM's Matthew Smith has more.
Unalakleet was one of several rural communities that said no to ballot measure 2. A village of fewer than 700 residents, 53% voted against legalizing marijuana.
Our community is family-oriented. We care for our children, and we don't want the exposure to marijuana. Life is hard enough as it is, and we don't need a... People just don't need another problem. It's not a good scene.
That's Joel Oyumik, a pastor at the Unalakleet Covenant Church. He says residents were dismayed to see ballot measure 2 succeed, even as it found strong support in rural areas, more so than it did statewide. In the Norton Sound neighborhood, it passed with a strong 57% yes vote, significantly better than the 52% yes votes across the state. But Unalakleet is one of many communities across Alaska that currently keeps alcohol out by using the local option. And it's a tool that some are considering when it comes to keeping marijuana out, too.
There's several options to local option, right? The way that alcohol is regulated, you know, the local options range from, you know, a complete ban of alcohol to a, you know, damp community to a wet community.
Cynthia Franklin is the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, the group tasked with setting up Alaska's laws for growing, selling, and buying marijuana, just as it does now for alcohol. But while the local option allows for communities to completely ban the sale and importation of alcohol, that won't be possible with the new marijuana laws. Franklin, who was a prosecutor before heading up the ABC board, says Alaska's courts ruled back in 1975 that possessing small amounts of marijuana is protected in the state constitution.
The Supreme Court in Raven versus Alaska said that every Alaskan, wherever they live in Alaska, has a constitutional right of privacy and possession of up to 4 ounces of marijuana in their own home. So it's not possible for a local community to completely ban possession of marijuana.
But each community, town, or city could hold a vote to put in place local option laws forbidding all the other parts of the legal marijuana business, including banning the sale, cultivation, or importation of the drug, even if it was legally bought elsewhere in the state.
So it's local option with an asterisk.
Even strong advocates for legal marijuana, like Taylor Bickford, the public spokesperson for the Ballot Measure 2 effort, says leaving the decision up to locals was part of the plan all along.
Communities throughout the state will have the option of banning the commercial marijuana industry if that's what they choose to do. That was the point of Ballot Measure 2, was to end prohibition and to put decision-making power back into the hands of local communities.
Franklin with the ABC board says that the state's marijuana laws are still taking shape from the day the election is officially certified, likely near the end of the month. The board will have about 9 months to craft a full regulatory system before the first legal marijuana sales can take place. Franklin says there's some freedom to that process, but any laws will have to stay true to what voters approved on the ballot.
We're walking a tightrope because the idea is to find a place where you can write regulations that take into account public safety and public health, some control measures at the same time without violating the intent of the initiative.
Franklin says it will be up to each community in the coming months to organize their own votes on whether or not they'll use the local option to keep marijuana on the legal blacklist. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Multimedia producers are in Alaska gathering audio for a project called Winter's Past. Their first stop was in Bethel, where they're talking with elders about how they've seen the climate change in their lifetimes. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
2 years ago, around Thanksgiving, Isaac Kestenbaum read an article in his local paper about how his grandparents' generation used to skate outside during Thanksgiving. Growing up in Maine, that was something he'd never seen because it wasn't cold enough. It got him thinking about preserving memories of winters past before they're lost to climate change.
So I just started to think about how winter is changing and how our expectations of winter as a season are changing. And I wanted to find a way to capture that. So we started this project called Winter's Past. And the idea is to capture memories of winter, the way winter used to be, to kind of preserve those memories, and then to share those memories and those stories with other people.
Brooklyn-based Kestenbaum grew up in Deer Isle, Maine. He's worked as a newspaper reporter and as a producer for the radio program StoryCorps. He and his wife, fellow multimedia producer Josie Holtzman, got a small grant to fund their project, and they began collecting stories in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. A highlight was talking with people who remember spending winters doing a sport called ice yachting. Imagine an ice skate merged with a sailboat, and that's essentially what the nearly forgotten sport is.
It used to happen right on the Hudson River, which is like the big river that runs through New York State. And it used to happen every winter regularly. The river would freeze from end to end, and thousands of people would come out to watch these ice yachts race each other. Today, that sport is carried on by a kind of handful of eccentric diehards who rarely get out on the ice as much as they used to because, you know, the winters are just getting so much warmer.
Then, last winter, Kestenbaum saw a news report about how there was nearly no snow on the ground in Alaska during the 2014 Iditarod. They booked their tickets for Alaska. Kestenbaum and Holtzman's first stop was in Bethel, gathering stories at the Senior Center. They'll also travel to Akiak, where they plan to interview dog mushers. They'll also be gathering stories in Anchorage and Kotzebue. The stories will be produced and shared through their Winter's Past podcast and eventually air on public radio programs. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Sitka School District has reached a settlement in a gender equity dispute over the community's new ball field. The resolution averts a full-blown civil rights investigation, but also means that high school baseball and softball will have to arrive at an equitable practice and game schedule at the city-owned field, a goal which has been difficult to achieve so far. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Superintendent Mary Wegner informed the school board Tuesday night that an agreement had been signed with the individual who filed the complaint under a federal anti-discrimination statute commonly known as Title IX.
The settlement proposed by the complainant was very realistic
and something that will really help us move our initiative forward in working with the sharing of Mulder Field.
The agreement was drafted by the Federal Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights under the so-called early complaint resolution process. The agreement makes further investigation into gender equity in the Sitka School District unnecessary. District officials feared that a full-blown Title IX investigation would put several relatively recent programs at risk, such as football and soccer. The agreement itself is only three paragraphs. It requires the district to develop a plan this fall for scheduling varsity baseball and softball teams for the 2015 season. The district must reaffirm its responsibility to ensure that both genders receive, quote, equivalent benefits with respect to practice and game facilities, close quote. And finally, the agreement does not constitute an admission of any violation of Title IX by the district, and the complaint is officially withdrawn.
You know, I'm really excited to see this.
This is softball coach Bob Petruski.
Practice facilities, times of practice, I mean, virtually everything that's where one team is using a facility, it's going to be on an equal basis with the other, and I think that's exactly what we wanted.
Mulder Field opened in 2012 after a $2.6 million renovation, including artificial turf and lights. Baseball, which historically played there, claimed the new field, though accommodations, such as a removable pitcher's mound and temporary outfield fence, were provided for softball games. And a final twist, Mulder Field doesn't belong to the district. It's owned by the city. Petruski says that created a gray area of scheduling that the Office of Civil Rights Resolution has fixed.
What it's really done is asserted the school district's authority to assign Mulder Field to high school teams.
Sitka's municipal government has already weighed in on the problem. It's proposed asking the legislature for $1.5 million in renovations to the Frank Valandry Field at Blatchley Middle School so that it can be used for softball and Little League. Superintendent Mary Wegner said the softball funding request was still on the table, and Coach Petruski, though perfectly content with the OCR settlement, wouldn't say no to a new field either.
I mean, if the community can bear it, if the state can bear it, if this is something that certainly people bigger than me think that they can provide for our kids, I'm all for it.
Petruski did not file the Title IX complaint. That individual's name will remain confidential. However, had the parties not arrived at an early resolution, the complainant would have been required to come forward in the public process associated with a Title IX investigation. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Juneau has some of the highest housing prices in Alaska. According to the State Department of Labor, the average single-family home costs $349,000 in the capital city. A typical rental unit is more than $1,000 per month. One way to combat the high cost of housing is to rent a slip on the docks for a houseboat or a liveaboard. KTOO's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Carrie Warren and her three children live on a boat in Aurora Harbor. She's originally from Washington State, but has lived in Alaska on and off for 20 years. In 2013, she moved to Juneau from Tendiki Springs. As soon as she came to town, she started looking for housing and found a houseboat that suited her needs.
I chose it because I could actually own it. There are not very many things in Juneau that you can purchase for $50,000 or less.
Warren says the seller financed the boat for her, and she paid it off in about a year and a half. She says harbor fees add up to around $200 a month, plus a little extra for utilities. The city's Docks and Harbors Department provides power, water, outhouses, and a sewage pump out. Lauren says cooking can be a challenge.
I have a Dickinson stove that doesn't work. It's not hooked up. And even if it did, that's mostly for heat. You can't bake on it. And I mean, you can heat water. I can make a mean pumpkin pie in my little toaster oven. I don't have a microwave. Electricity is hard because you can't have too many things happening at once. You blow your breaker.
Warren is a single mother who homeschools her kids, and the boat is about 200 square feet. She says sometimes it's a challenge to make sure the family gets along in such a small area. Warren's older son plays upright bass and her daughter French horn, and they need to arrange individual practice times.
Our space and boundaries are different than most people's. And rather than sit around and whine about it, you just suck it up and you just do what you got to do.
Katie Spielberger is Warren's neighbor. She lives in a houseboat with her partner and a cat.
A couple of our neighbors have seen the cat and have come by with an extra can of cat food or half a container of kitty litter that they found in the free bin.
Spielberger works for the state and has been in Juneau for about 9 years. She compares living on a boat to the tiny house movement in which architects design homes that are less than 400 square feet. Spielberger says living in a small area has made her more creative.
It's kind of nice to have that challenge to simplify things, and it feels very rewarding when you actually can live in such a small space and have everything you need.
She says she hangs as much as she can on walls, takes advantage of all available space, and rents a storage unit. Spielberger says living on a houseboat provides the best of Juneau at an affordable price.
It feels very much of this place. You don't feel like you're living in a house that could be anywhere. The views surrounding a boat in any harbor in southeast Alaska, I think, are gorgeous and hard to beat, except at some very, very nice land property.
In addition to houseboats, some people in Juneau have liveaboards. Harbor Master Dave Borg explains the difference.
There's a liveaboard vessel, which is just a, you know, your normal boat that somebody might live on. And then we do have some houseboats designated specifically just as a houseboat. They generally don't have any motive power.
Borg says there are 9 houseboats in Aurora, 3 in Douglas Harbor, 2 in Harris Harbor, and nearly 140 liveaboards. Monthly moorage fees are $4.20 per foot. Warren says there are unique problems with houseboats, but they're mostly in line with other homeowner concerns.
When it's real windy, it's a little freaky. You know, I worry about things like my canvas blowing away. But, you know, I think any homeowner, when it's stormy and yucky, has those same kinds of worries. Anybody who's living in a not super well insulated home has those same kinds of worries.
And she says it's more affordable than other housing alternatives. In Juneau, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver and Homer, Ed Schoenfeld and Kayla DeRoche in Juneau, Matthew Smith in Nome, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.